ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you really? Do you?
Yeah, wait. I'm going to get a link to the picture and send it to you right now, the big merino.
Oh, my God. That's so great.
Does have really big ram balls.
Do you know, if that was in this country, those balls would be endlessly being stolen by students.
What the Duck is the ABC's nature show where wild ideas get tamed. And in this episode, the cotton balls you see in the paddock on your country drive. Sheepies! They're not all flock and followers. In fact, there's more to the flock than meets the ear. Some sheep are out there scheming, planning their perfect life away from their muster dog overlords. If only they can just work out how to open the gate.
Hi!
I'm Dr. Anne Jones.
Hi, I'm Anne.
I'm Tara.
Tara goes by Tara Farms on all of the social media platforms.
Yeah. So this is the family farm?
Yes, yeah. Third generation. We've got 7,000 mature ewes.
She's a sheep farmer and also a sheep influencer.
That's all right. There you go. Hang on. There you go.
And cursing them.
Oh, my titty! Jesus! That was my fault. I should have gone on the other side.
Yeah.
We have our first cross ewes, which is a merino cross border Leicester. As well, and we breed fat lambs off of them, so they're crossed with a Dorset, but we're moving to a prime line production, which is a composite breed.
All that is to say that they've got several breeds and plans, and it's all aimed towards good meat production.
Wool doesn't really have the industry it used to have here, so meat is the option to go with.
This is a bit of a historic change, not just for Tara's family. When the first fleet arrived in Australia, it bought a small flock of sheep convicted of petty crimes. But it was in 1798 that the first Spanish merino arrived in Australia. Immigrants, am I right? And the wool industry really kicked off. So much so that 100 years later, at the Sydney Wool Exchange, apparently it wasn't unusual for 45,000 kilograms of wool to be traded in an afternoon. That is a lot of jumpers. And if you peruse the Australiana section at your local bookshop, you'll find reference to the fact that Australia was built on the sheep's back, which isn't really very big, so it is actually very impressive. But sheep are more than that. Australian sheep have been scientific pioneers.
Sheep have been, for many years, Australia's experimental animal, you know, laboratory animal almost.
Professor Gareth Evans,
allegedly written by Gareth Evans to Cheryl Curnow, referring to a grand consuming passion.
No, not that Gareth Evans, a different one, is an emeritus professor with the University of Sydney.
There was plenty of them, and they were fairly cheap to run, and most research institutions all had field stations, often quite close to town, so they could run sheep freely and cheaply and perform various experiments, particularly in the line of animal husbandry experiments, but later on a bit in the medical field as well.
So where did all this start, this human-sheep science friendship of sorts?
We can trace the journey of various sheep breeds right back in time.
Sally Coulthard would know. She's written a book called The History of the World According to Sheep, and quite frankly, I'm here for it.
But sometime between 20 and 10 million years ago, the earliest sheep evolved in the kind of mountain regions of Central Asia. Some trotted west into Europe, some went east into China and Siberia and places like that, and some even crossed over what would have been the frozen Bering Straits and went into North America. And those different groups have evolved into their own unique versions of sheep.
And some of them bumped into scheming humans looking to start a farm in their Minecraft world.
Between about 11,000 years ago and about 9,000 years ago, there is evidence of the changes in way which people kept sheep. So they're starting to be kept in kind of small enclosures in large numbers in flocks on the edge of the settlement. And so they've turned essentially a kind of wild resource slowly over time into a farmed resource.
And don't forget, the haggis, a good haggis is as good as any sausage, I can tell you.
Gareth Evans back again. But yes, along with domestication came a whole suite of uses and cultural integration of the sheep and our lives.
And I'm not even a Scotsman, but I think the first bag of the bagpipes was a sheepskin, you know, so they've been used for various reasons for a long time.
Like contraception.
I've also got cockerels crowing in the background. I'm so sorry,
but I can hear that.
Apt. But yes, it's not just shepherd's pie we've got the sheep to thank for. It's condoms.
I read an archaeological paper about some dig on the edge of an English castle, and in the ditch outside the castle, they dug up loads of medieval condoms. And I thought, oh my God, brilliant thing to find. Like, that's archaeology, isn't it, really? It's, you know, never mind the golden plates and the chalices. I want to find, you know, ye olde condoms. So I started to do some research about it. And actually, Roman soldiers would use sheep intestines that were washed, because sheep gut is actually fabulously flexible and robust and really useful. They would literally cut a section of sheep intestine and drape it over your member and tie it on somehow. And I love the idea that you kind of tied it with a jaunty ribbon, as if you were handing someone a present.
We don't want your present, mate.
But all joking aside, actually, it was probably one of the only ways of preventing sexually transmitted diseases, because, you know, obviously, you know, syphilis was rife. And so really, it played a kind of massive part in public health.
The watertight nature of sheep intestines has meant that they could be fashioned into all sorts of things, water bottles included. It was the Stanley mug of its time, if you will. Everyone had one. And like so many of the animals we share our space with, they make their way into language and culture.
Dyed in the wool, better hung for a sheep than a lamb, all that kind of stuff.
Wolf in sheep's clothing, baa-baa black sheep. Coincidentally, also groundbreaking because it was one of the first ever computer-generated tunes recorded at Alan Turing's computing laboratory in 1951. Absolute banger. Anyway, what is baa-baa black sheep actually all about?
So in medieval times in England, vast sums of money were earned through wool trade. And we're talking millions and millions and millions and millions of pounds. And so it was always very kind of greedily watched by the government and taxed very heavily.
And the nursery rhyme? That is thought to pertain to these tax rises, where the producer became less and less likely to profit at all from the primary product. And gee, that sounds familiar.
That the master is supposed to be the government, dame is supposed to be the wool merchants, and the little boy is supposed to represent the shepherd or the sheep farmers. After all the heavy taxes were taken off and the fact that the wool trade was so controlled, the only people making any money out of it were really the government and the wool traders.
Who knew that right through childhood we were singing songs about taxation? But I suppose we shouldn't really be surprised about the meaning behind sheepy lyrics, because Waltzing Matilda features sheep and it's about the class divide. Not that all sheep end up as chops for the rich man. I reckon that every farm I've ever visited, there's always been a sheep, at least one, that was special.
Yes, I've got 25 of them.
Is that what we're looking at?
Yes, that's what you're looking at.
Back with Tara Farms, the YouTubing sheep farmer.
Why are these ones the special ones? Why are these the chosen ones?
My mums didn't want them.
Oh.
Someone's got to want them.
Oh, is that you?
I suppose.
But there's no one else to take them.
Yeah, no one else wanted them, so I had to have them. To the lambs, if you've raised them from a bottle, your mum. Whereas sheep that have been raised on mum, they're essentially wild here. Mm-hmm. My pet sheep have had lambs, and their lambs have been not as friendly as their mums. They never will be.
So fascinating. So they didn't learn that behaviour from their mum. They sort of, the wildness kicked straight back in.
It's just instinct of their prey animal. If that's what they need to do to survive, they need to be scared of other things.
But there's more to sheep brains than lamb's fry.
You are so right.
Thank you. Sally Coulthard, sheep farmer, sheep author, sheep advocate.
And it really annoys me, actually, when people, you know, you're all just following the flock. And in the pandemic, people were called sheep. And that, you know, became a really sort of like loaded word to be a sheep or to be part of a flock. If you're having to watch out for predators, there is nothing more sensible than being part of a group.
It is interesting that the sheep was chosen for this derogatory meaning, because bees swarm, birds flock, cows herd, owls parliament, penguins colonise, crows murder. Sheep are not the only animal that have a group identity.
And actually Australia is one of the leading countries that's doing research about sheep intelligence and sheep behaviour.
And one of our experts
started off working on social behaviour in lizards.
Oh.
Quite different to the sheep.
Dr. Stefan Leoi is with the University of Adelaide and made a career switch from reptiles to sheep some years back. Sensible.
And you can do cool experiments with sheep because you can put them in a paddock with a fence around it and have certain experimental treatments that are a lot more difficult to do in wildlife.
Right, makes them an easy animal to study. So, how complex are sheep flocks?
Sheep have a very dynamic social system with fission-fusion mechanisms where the larger group splits up into smaller ones and then they fuse to larger groups again, so highly dynamic, really interesting.
They don't just lurk in exactly the same formation all day, every day.
Visualize sort of the whole mob of the sheep.
Oh, is this like a meditation? Love it. Okay. I've got a wide open paddock in mind, a couple of huge old eucalypts. I've got a big mob of 100 or so ewes clustered around a dam.
And then they split up into smaller subgroups of maybe about 8 individuals.
Right. Off they go into a more dispersed sort of pattern across the paddock, noses down, munching as they go.
And then at different areas and different times of the day, they fuse again to larger groups.
Back again, flowing together like water into the dam.
Depending on the conditions, sometimes larger groups are more beneficial and sometimes smaller groups are more beneficial.
Sometimes they hang out close together and sometimes further apart, though rarely, if ever, alone. And Stefan found that there's a daily pattern to this fission and fusion of sheep society.
The largest group sizes are early in the morning and late in the afternoon, and there's also another sort of peak in the middle of the day. So the larger group sizes coincide with the periods when the sheep are mostly inactive. And we think that is the case because during those inactive periods, they don't forage. So the benefits of being in a larger group, for example, spotting predators and sharing vigilance, that sort of stuff.
Being a sheeple can be more beneficial than flying like a lone eagle. Be smart, sheeple. But wait, all of these partnerships between humans and sheep for science, does it mean that the sheep are intelligent? There's been a fair bit of research into different types of sheep cognition.
You know, sheep can recognise 50 faces. They can distinguish between happy faces and sad faces in humans. Amazingly, just like humans, prefer smiley faces. They've shown them to be amazing navigators of mazes, of complex mazes, and each time a sheep does the maze, it gets quicker and quicker.
Researchers even found that if they took the sheep away for a holiday for 3 months and then put it back into the maze, it'd remember which way and it would equal its best time. As a non-sheep, non-scientist, I'd interpret that as them actually being pretty darn good navigators.
The sheep will know the way to the shed. They know which fence to walk along. They know where to escape through the fence. You can take a sheep out of a paddock and then put them back in there months later and they'll still find the same hole if you haven't patched it. There's also sheep trails in the grass that they make that goes directly from food to water because they all walk in a Congo line.
Sheep are interesting when it comes to leadership. What do you notice?
There's definitely leaders and there's definitely your weaker ones. Sheep will bully each other when you put grain out. You'll start to see a tail in your mob. They'll get skinnier and they'll start to lose condition. Whereas your heavier sheep, they're your ones that are in charge. We're looking at my pet sheep right now. I know which one's in charge. And as soon as she gets up, they're all going to get up and start following her away.
Which one's in charge?
One right there, that fat one.
Why do you think it's her?
Oh, you can just look at them and you know she kind of keeps everyone in check. And the one she's next to, he's the big boy that kind of keeps the peace.
Oh, that makes it sound sort of like a romance novel or something.
No, it's a fight club out there.
And the rules of Sheep Fight Club state that you do not talk about sheep business. You keep sheep business very, very quiet and complete it under the cover of darkness.
There's a little village, a little hill village called Marsden.
This is in Yorkshire. Think stone buildings, the township's dominated by a huge old woolen mill, green rolling hills, the moors.
And the residents of Marsden were really fed up because they couldn't understand why their flowers in their flower bed were being eaten.
Night after night, something was eating their lovely gardens.
Couldn't have possibly the sheep, because the sheep were on the moors all around.
And the town was protected by grids and fences. Impassable.
They got so fed up, and then finally they watched the sheep at night, and under the cover of darkness, apparently the sheep had learned to do kind of commando rolls over the sheep grids.
Think Tom Cruise rolling under a closed garage door, just like that.
With some laying on their side and rolling over the, you know, one or two learned to do it and then showed the rest of the flock. So not only is that showing kind of like amazing problem solving, but also, you know, the communication of knowledge, all of which are things that we associate with higher intelligence. And I just think sheep are much cannier than people give them credit for.
Yes, they will literally contort like a mouse to get through gates. They look fat, but they can, I don't know where it goes, but they can squeeze through some holes. They will jump fences like show ponies. If there is food on the other side of the fence, there's three things to know about sheep. They need to sleep, they need to eat, and they need water. If they see food, they're going to go and eat it. You put food on this other side of this fence, they will come and eat it.
They do say the grass is greener.
You could have like the Berlin Wall in between them. They're going to get through it.
They'll get rock climbing gear out. You watch. They'll make it out of their fleece.
Despite this apparent Houdini ability when something looks yummy somewhere else, it's sheep's docility and ease of husbandry that has cemented their ongoing role in our lives.
Sheep have been unwittingly dragged into scientific experiments for two reasons. One is just sheer proximity and the value, but also I think they were probably viewed as the nearest proxy to a human body.
But more recently, sheep have been used in medicinal research.
The Department of Animal Husbandry, as it was at the University of Sydney, really was instrumental in development of AI in Australia.
Yes, sheep were among the first programmers to crack artificial intelligence. No, we're talking about artificial insemination, AI. Emeritus Professor Gareth Evans.
What the member for Swans said was totally baseless.
Not that Gareth Evans. From the University of Sydney is back. So cast your imagination back to the late 1950s.
The sheep industry in Australia was massive.
Millions of sheep, millions of dollars.
It started with Professor Terry Robinson,
who specialised in animal husbandry.
One of the key appointments in his early days was almost by accident, was a chap called Stephen Salomon. Stephen fought with the Hungarian army in the war, and he fought with the Germans, and he lost to the Russians on the last day of the war. And he spent 2 years in Siberian prison, and he was one of the lucky ones who survived. Most of the Germans didn't.
After his release, he returned to Hungary and then returned to Russia as a PhD student. He was taught there by the then leaders of artificial insemination, but as the Hungarian Revolution engulfed his home country, he actually ended up in Australia working as a gardener. You couldn't make it up.
Turned up at Sydney University looking for a job.
If only a postdoc was that easy these days.
Terry Robbins employed him, but he quickly discovered Stephen's skills in artificial insemination.
They made an incredible team. Stephen was the first one to freeze semen in Australia, and he developed methods of diluting semen samples and preserving them. This is a key step in the artificial insemination pathway, of course, because it's no use being able to stuff semen anywhere if it's kaput. Professor Robinson, for his part, developed a way to modify the female reproductive cycle so that all the ewes would come into oestrus at the same time. It involved a homemade pessary soaked in hormones, and that was a precursor to the work that led to the pill. So thank you, Professor Robinson. But why do we need artificial insemination for our sheep flocks? What's wrong with the old method?
it's really just a matter of advancing the rate of genetic gain. So if you get a particularly valuable ram, you know, it might be able to cover 50 ewes or something in a season, whereas it could do many hundreds through artificial insemination. In the early days, it wasn't particularly possible because frozen semen doesn't easily get through the cervix of a sheep, which is particularly convoluted. So it took some development back in my early days of laparoscopic insemination, which bypasses the cervix and puts the frozen semen straight into the uterus.
Why are sheep cervixes so convoluted?
Seriously, how the duck did we end up here?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's got sort of overlapping folds, you know. Sperm, of course, can find around them. It's a bit of a roller coaster ride for natural sperm.
I wonder if those thousands and thousands of people who have been now born via this technology know that they've got sheep to thank.
Well, yes, more than that, most of the people in the background at all these IVF labs, a lot of them are just trained in, as agriculture students, you know, working with animal embryos.
Apparently the vet and animal husbandry professors would get calls asking if they had anyone with experience to make the hop directly over into human artificial insemination procedures. It's something we take for granted these days. But those steps of hormone control, of collecting and freezing and thawing sheep sprog in New South Wales, revolutionised livestock and human reproduction around the world. And speaking of sheep seed...
For when we're collecting semen, for example, you know, if you have them all together in a pen, they learn from each other, but they get a bit too excited and then they start jumping each other if you're not careful and you lose the semen.
Yeah, we're going there. Gay sheep. Listen up, honey. Gay rams in particular.
Some percentage, a rather high percentage of rams just weren't interested in use. And so the first studies set the numbers at about 8%. Of these populations of domesticated rams seem to have a same-sex preference. We're not going out in the field and saying, oh, look at that guy mounting another guy and saying he's male-oriented. No, that's not what we do. We actually give them choice tests. The testing extended over 2 years because we wanted to know that it was an enduring kind of preference.
But Charles Roselli didn't set out to prove that gay rams exist. Previous scientists had already done that. He's a chemical physiologist. He wanted to investigate if there was a mechanism behind the differences in sexual preference.
Well, the major hypothesis was, is this behavior programmed into the brain before the animal's even born? Actually, we're testing a broader hypothesis about how the brain becomes sexually differentiated and whether this behavior is influenced by the degree to which the brain is exposed to testosterone during the period when the brain is sexually differentiating.
Studying the formation of sheep brains while the sheep are still in utero, it's a huge challenge. But after narrowing down which cluster of cells in the brain to focus on...
That cluster was called the sexually dimorphic nuclei, and it was always larger in males than in females.
Charles could finally ask, was there any difference between the rams who liked rams and the rams who liked ewes?
And we did find that it was larger in female-oriented rams than in male-oriented rams, and that the male-oriented rams were similar to what the ewes. This cluster of cells was similar in size. So that supported the hypothesis that the size of this cluster correlated with sexual preference.
This leads my mind immediately to ask about our own exposure to testosterone in the womb. Does this lead to different sexual preferences? But anyway, the point of this actually is that sheep are still being co-opted into our scientific exploration of sexuality and development. What started as a Roman condom could end who knows where.
Everything from kind of womb transplants to IVF to blood transfusion. Sheep were absolutely central to pretty much most significant kind of early medical breakthroughs. And no one kind of says, oh, thanks, you know, or no one kind of even really recognises it.
That is a good point. I think everyone should go out and say thank you to a sheep then. Go out and say thank you, you ungrateful bastards.
Yeah, absolutely.
What the Duck is an ABC Science and ABC RN and Sheep
production. Details of all of our guests and where to find them are on our website, abc.net.au/whattheduck. I'm Anne Jones, and I make the program with Patria Ladgrove from Wadawurrung and Kaurna Country.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.